Well, welcome to another session of the Vancouver Institute, another season of the Vancouver Institute, a rather special season. The Institute this year is 70 years old. It was founded in 1915-1916, intended, of course, to be a link between a rather fledgling university and a still very much a pioneer society. Then, of course, the university was on the Fairview slopes. It was not to come out here until the 1920s, although there had been a site commission in 1911, had toured the province, listening to all sorts of pleas for the university in this or that spot. The North Shore had said that it was a particularly favored spot for the university. It was a sunny southern exposure with no poisonous snakes. But the site commissioners put the university here. They thought that students would be rather protected by high-minded professors and by a surrounding nature. Of course, they had no idea of the sort of exposed nature that would appear on on Spanish banks. There was a good deal of initial tension about the university. There were those, you see, who would tuck it away, and there were others who thought that the university should be very much part of a new society. Well, those who've been involved with the Vancouver Institute over the years have had the latter view, have seen the university as a link, the Vancouver Institute as a link between the university and this society. A place where, indeed, as it has evolved over the years, the Vancouver Institute Saturday night has become one of the forums of the city, a place where the university and the community meet and talk with each other. The Institute has certainly had its ups and downs over those 70 years, but during the last years, under the most effective program direction of Mrs. Bell Nemetz. The Institute has certainly been on the up. The program that you have before you, that you should have picked up a copy, is the brochure, is really a remarkable creation, and it is very largely her work. So welcome, a hearty welcome to the Vancouver Institute and to its 70th year. Now, of course, we want you to join. Membership dues are very modest, and your financial support is needed. Institute speakers are not paid, but there are considerable expenses. There could not be otherwise in bringing a program of this quality to you week by week. So please do join, and please, if you can, make a donation. Under the good auspices of the chairman last year, Dick Vogel, it was arranged that both membership dues and donations be tax deductible. So keep that in mind. Even your dues, your paltry dues to the Vancouver Institute are tax deductible. And above all, of course, whether you join or not, what we value is your presence here. This has been always true, and particularly, I think, now, in these times when the university is feeling somewhat buffeted. You are, as a member of the Institute, and in your participation here, you are part of the larger community of the university. So please do come. Please join if you can. Please make a donation. Just a word on Institute procedures. Tonight and every Saturday night after the lecture, there will, of course, be questions. I will identify the questioner, but the questions should be directed to the speaker. He or she will repeat the question or reinterpret the question so that all of you have heard what is being responded to. If, as is the case tonight, there are overflow audiences in other rooms, Then, after the lecture, the speaker and I will repair to those rooms and take several questions, perhaps two in each, and then return here. So wherever you are in this room, or I think there are at least 2.5 other rooms occupied tonight, when the lecture is over, just stay put. There will be an opportunity where you are to ask questions of the speaker. Our speaker tonight, as all of you know, is Dr. David Strangway. I have here Dr. Strangway's curriculum vitae. It is massive. It is dense. It's enormously impressive. Well, let me try to give you a rather mere précis. Now, I'm going to have to read this because I feel introducing Dr. Strangway, I must get my facts at least approximately right. Dr. Strangway was born in the on the Niagara Peninsula of southern Ontario in 1934, son of medical missionaries of the United Church of Canada. Much of his boyhood was spent in Africa, in Angola, and in Zimbabwe. In 1952, he entered the University of Toronto, doing a BA in geology and physics, and going on quickly to the MA and the PhD. The latter in 1960. His scholarly life has been spent in geophysics, working principally on the history of magnetism. He has published a book, The History of the Earth's Magnetic Field, and some 150 articles on topics ranging from magnetic anomalies in Precambrian dikes to studies of the magnetism of the moon and of lunar materials, and the magnetism of some of the planets. As I understand it, the study of magnetism, at least as practiced by Dr. Strangway, is an entree to the geological history of the Earth and of the solar system. His work in geophysics has led him in many directions. He has worked for Falconbridge and for Kennecott Copper as a research geophysicist, developing and testing geophysical tools. He began to teach at the University of Colorado in 1961, developing courses in exploration geophysics and in the physics of the Earth. In 1965, he moved to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and there began to work out methods to analyze lunar samples for ancient magnetism. This, of course, before such samples were available. In 1968, he returned to the University of Toronto, to the Department of Physics. At the same time, he was becoming increasingly involved with lunar programs. As principal investigator of the study of returned lunar samples, and as one of the authors of the scientific summary of the first Apollo mission. In 1970, he left the University of Toronto to join NASA as chief of the geophysical branch. A huge job, as he was now responsible for the geophysical side of the Apollo missions. This involved the selection of experiments, the training of astronauts, the identification of landing sites, and the provision of scientific advice during the actual missions. He chaired the Science Working Panel, which was responsible for the allocation of surface time on the moon to various experiments. He also became acting chief of the Planetary and Earth Sciences Division, responsible for all aspects of planetary science in Houston. In 1973, he returned to the University of Toronto as chairman of the Department of Geology. From then until the present, his scientific career has continued unabated, basically on magnetic properties of lunar samples, on meteorites, and on electromagnetic methods of sounding. If my count is correct, there are currently 12 papers in press. At the same time, he was becoming increasingly involved with various national and international geoscience groups, chairman of the Canadian Geophysical Union, President of the Geological Association of Canada, Vice President of the Society of Exploration Geophysicists, President of the Canadian Geoscience Council. He acted as a consultant to companies and government agencies. At the university, he obtained the transfer of a valuable laboratory from NASA and arranged a large negotiated development grant from the National Research Council, the largest ever awarded in earth sciences, and planned a center for natural resources, a large building near the heart of the campus, now approved for construction. He also coordinated faculty in the departments of physics and geology to obtain financial support for IsoTrace, the world's most sensitive mass spectrometric analytical facility, now under construction. In 1980, he became vice president and provost of the University of Toronto. And in 1983, after the untimely death of the president-elect, he became president for a year, fully responsible for the management of the largest university in Canada and its budget of more than $500 million. Broadly, his initiatives while provost and president of the University of Toronto have been to encourage and reward excellence in teaching and research, to increase departmental responsibility while maintaining academic accountability, to improve procedures for selecting students who would be likely to do well at the university, and to maintain close liaison with leaders in industry and government. Plans were made for an incubator center for high technology spin-off companies and for an institute of theoretical astrophysics. At the same time, and in difficult circumstances, senior appointments were being made in both the sciences and the humanities. Amid high-tech, space-age technology, there was, it seems to me, at least, a particular note of sanity. A group of accomplished medieval musicians were supported financially as the president's players. During the course of this packed career, Dr. Strangway has, as you might expect, won many awards. To name a few of them, the Virgil Kaufman Gold Medal of the Society for Exploration Geophysics, the Gold Medal of the Geological Association of Canada, the Senior Isaac Walton Killam Memorial Scholarship, Canada's most prestigious award in the sciences. He is a fellow of the Royal Society. As most of you know, in November, Dr. Strangway will become the 10th president of the University of British Columbia. None of his predecessors has better combined high academic attainment with broad experience in university administration and with government and private industry. He is undoubtedly one of the most able and most broadly experienced scientists in Canada. Sir, we eagerly anticipate your coming. But this is neither the time nor the occasion to welcome you to the University of British Columbia. There will be time enough for that. It is the occasion to welcome you to the Vancouver Institute, almost as old as the university itself, now in its 70th year, a venerable institution in its own right, and through all that time, an essential link joining the university to the community it serves. So, a warm welcome to you, sir, to the Vancouver Institute, from all of us. We're delighted to have you here and are greatly looking forward to your lecture on exploring the planets. Dr. David Strangway.
Thank you very much. At least my CV was not in the form of one I saw recently. It had a table of contents. I thought for a moment also, Dr. Harris, that you were giving my speech that I'm sure I'm going to have to give in the future years. Please contribute, please donate, please be part of the seed, but I'm sure that wasn't my topic tonight. It's a very great pleasure for me to be here, to be joining the community in British Columbia and in Vancouver. My wife is with me this evening, are extremely pleased about this opportunity and are looking forward to being here and moving here in the very near future. It's a very special occasion this evening, not only because I'm addressing the Vancouver Institute for the first time, but I don't think it's very often you can stand up in front of an audience of thousands and say, by pure coincidence, this also happens to be our 28th wedding anniversary. Maybe we'll go out for dinner another night. Tonight, I thought I would just give you a sort of a guided tour through the solar system. I'm going to leave out parts of it because they are not the parts that those people in the geosciences concern themselves with. So I won't talk about such large objects as the Sun, Jupiter, Saturn. I will talk about their satellites, however, because those objects have turned out to be just incredibly fascinating. We're going to perhaps, within the next few months, learn a great deal more about the satellites of Uranus, when the spacecraft arrives there sometime along in December and January, but I can't tell you a thing about them tonight. Before the Apollo program was started, one of the great scientists of the day, Harold Urey, said, when we land on the lunar surface, we will have the Rosetta Stone for the solar system. What I think I will convey to you tonight is we didn't by any means at all have the Rosetta Stone for the solar system. We got some important clues and some important new information. Without what we've learned about the moon, we would not be able to interpret the rest of the planets to nearly the degree we can. What he meant by the Rosetta Stone is finally we're going to find some stuff that isn't messed up by all these geological processes on Earth, like continents moving around and oceans and volcanoes and things of this sort. We're really going to get fresh stuff out of the earliest part of the solar system. Well, as it turned out, and as I'll explain to you, we didn't get that. We got some very interesting stuff, and we're still looking for the rest of the Rosetta Stone, although I think we got some parts of it in the process. So lots of excitement, but also continuing frustrations and continuing excitement about what's yet to come. Well, I have a lot of slides. I have a feeling I'm not going to get to the very end of them, but I'm going to show you a fair number of them. And I'd like to start off with a brief description of the moon itself. It will be very brief because all I want to do is hit a few highlights and then we will look at Mercury, Venus, Mars, and so on and see what, in light of what we've learned from the moon, we can say about some of the other objects in the solar system. So I think I push this button. This is a picture of the front face of the moon. You will remember, perhaps, that we have not yet seen the far side, except by the crews, by the astronauts, who, of course, have gone around the far side. But we ourselves have now lots of good pictures, but we don't very often get a good look from the Earth. This is simply to remind you of the two or three major points that I want to make now and then come back to several times during the talk. You will notice, of course, that the moon is divided into these very light-colored highlands, very, very heavily cratered, bombarded, impacted, just incredibly damaged as a result of many meteorites and asteroids and so on that have bombarded the surface of the moon. But what's intriguing is that these dark areas, the Mare Basins, as they're referred to, the Mare Basins, while they have some craters on them, and some impact sites are also very smooth, and they are much younger looking, much fresher looking than the light-colored stuff on the surface. In fact, if the rate of meteorites that was banging into the surface of the moon over geological time was a constant process, so that every year there were as many on the average as there were the year before and the year before that, you would have to say that this part of the moon was very old and this part, these parts of the moon were in fact very young. Well, we now know that that's in fact not the case, although, I'll give you the time scale in a minute, and I'll tell you why and how we were able to calibrate the bombardment rate or the cratering rates on a planetary surface. Shown on here are the various landing sites. Apollo 11, for example, the famous one here, but Apollo 16, 14, 15 up in here by the Mare Basins in the highlands. Apollo 17, just the last of the missions over here again at the edge of the Mare Basins and into the highlands. You can also see the two Russian sample return missions, Luna 16 and Luna 20, from which we had a few grams of material return from unmanned missions. Up here, the Russians landed a spacecraft and actually had a rover that traversed across a little bit of the lunar surface. So we have samples from quite a wide range of spots on the surface of the moon, and we've got a good collection of material from the highlands and from the dark Mare Basins. A few pictures. This is one that you could not see very well from the Earth. It's Mare Orientale, just on the limb of the moon. If you know where it is, you can actually see the little piece off the side of the moon when you look at it with the naked eye. But, of course, during the missions, we got these very beautiful photographs. And again, you can see the smooth, dark material on the surface, much smoother and younger looking than the heavily cratered old highland surfaces on the surface. A fairly spectacular picture, again emphasizing the light-colored highlands, heavily bombarded, and the fresh-looking Mare Basins. This is the difference close up. This is a picture taken from the Apollo 17 landing site, and you can see in the foreground the ground-up powdered surface material, but underlain by dark volcanic rocks all across this smooth plain, and in the background you see the highlands of the moon, the very old material. So this stuff is old in appearance. This stuff is young in appearance, relatively speaking. Here, of course, you see the lunar module. You see, by pure coincidence, the astronauts laying out the experiment that I myself was involved in right here. As I say, that's just pure coincidence. I picked that one. You get a little bit of a sense of what the surface is like. It's kind of crunchy and a bit like wet beach sand. You can see these beautiful tracks. The only thing messing these tracks up for many millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, will be small meteorites bombarding the surface and slowly turning it over. And eventually these will erode away. But it'll be many, many millions of years before they're gone. And again, this is the transmitter that we put up. A few pictures of some of the samples. This is a volcanic sample taken from the foreground of the earlier pictures I just showed you from the dark Mare Basins. Very smooth surfaces, very fresh-looking rocks. If a geologist here were to crack open this sample and look at the inside of it, he would say, I didn't believe that volcanic rocks could come looking so fresh. There's no water, there's no fluid, there's no moisture, there's no eroding, there's no deterioration, no clay minerals and this sort of thing. And so these, although we now know this sample is about 3.8 or 3.9 billion years in age, it is absolutely fresher looking than any terrestrial sample that you could imagine. So it's been sitting up there, having erupted in a volcanic flow 3.9 billion years back. This is a piece of the material from the lunar highlands. This came from the Apollo 15 landing site. And you can see why I'll take a minute to describe this, and the point basically is why the moon didn't turn out to be quite the Rosetta Stone for the earliest history of the solar system. These rocks are the result of many, many, many impacts. The rocks are bombarded by meteorites, they're broken apart, and sometimes they're welded back together again with the heat of the shock that takes place. And what you have here is the black material, which was from the volcanic rocks. You have the white material, which is what we believe comes from much deeper within the moon, a north acidic rock, they call it. And yet it's all welded together and it's battered and broken apart. If you could take a fine look at this, you would see little tiny particles which were the result of earlier bombardment cycles and yet earlier bombardment cycles. And all of this took place, if you date this rock, it turns out to be about 4 billion years. So the difference between the smooth surfaces that we just looked at and the rather young-looking, fresh-looking surfaces and these very old, heavily cratered, bombarded surfaces is very small in geological terms. This stuff is 4 billion years old, and the stuff we just looked at is 3.9 billion years old. So something dramatic happened in the solar system between that at that time. So dramatic, in fact, that all of these things have been reheated, the gases that were there have been driven out, the geological clocks have been reset, and it's almost impossible to get back and understand what happened before that intense bombardment period that took place 4 billion years ago. So, in a way, it's a Rosetta Stone because it tells us that immense amount of bombardment was taking place 4 billion years ago in the solar system, and that stopped or slowed down. It didn't stop altogether, but it slowed down dramatically in less than 100 million years, and from then on, there have just been occasional events that have taken place. So we thought we had a nice clock, but the clock saturates very quickly, and we can't see very much further back in lunar materials than about 4 billion years. Just a picture taken at the Apollo 11, 17 landing site. This is a small crater, which was much younger than 3.9 billion years, so things didn't stop altogether. They kept on going. This is rather an exciting one at the time because the geologist astronaut that was on the surface saw some orange colors around in the side here and he thought, aha, I got some signs of fluids, I got some signs of moistures, I really got it, fellas. And the back room got terribly excited and so on, and they said, make sure you get samples, and he scrambled around on the edges here to get them and so on. And when they came back, they were just pieces of orange glass bead. So we didn't even find in this stuff much sign of fluids taking action on the lunar surface. Very, very dry. Well, that's a fairly simple slide. today and 4 billion years, I will show you variants of this slide as we go through. 4 billion years, of course, the time of that I've just mentioned of the intense bombardment in the solar system. And from the study of meteorites, we believe the solar system actually started 4.6 billion years ago. So we've got this marker and we've got this interval of time that we couldn't tell very much about from the surface of the moon. Well, now for each of the satellites and so on that we come to, I'll show you a slide something like this, just summarizing the major events. These are the volcanic flows. Some places they're quite a bit younger than others. On the western side of the moon, they're as young as about 3.3 billion years, whereas over by the Apollo 17 landing site, about 3.9. And then this intense bombardment period in here at around 4 billion years. But something we know happened earlier than that, not just the formation of the planet, but we know that there is a crust on the surface of the moon. It's perhaps 100 kilometers or so thick. It's made of lighter rock, and there's denser rock deep in the inside. So we know that the moon has some layering, some large-scale layering. We don't know if it has a core deep in the inside, but we do know that early in its formation time, it went through some kind of a partial melting process and formed light stuff floated to the surface and heavy stuff floated to the or sank to the deep interior. And that is going to turn out to be a process that we can infer. We can't say very much about it, but it's probably happened in most of the larger planetary bodies. So I've simply put question marks here. We don't know when it happened. We believe it happened during the formation process itself, and we believe it happened, as I said earlier, then at 4.6 billion years. But most of our observed history that we can really work with in geological events is contained in here, and it's true we got a piece of time marker for the solar system, but we didn't get very much concrete information about the formation process. A picture on the highlands, just to again illustrate to you the intense shock and bombardment process. These rocks are what geologists refer to as breccias. They're just pieces upon pieces, broken apart, welded together again, and then these enormous boulders on the surface of the moon. Well, let's turn to some of the other planetary objects. The Mariner 10 spacecraft flew by Mercury, and no one had any idea of what the surface of Mercury was going to look like until this spacecraft came within a few hundreds of thousands of kilometers of the surface of that planet and took some pretty good pictures for us. This picture, to me, if I didn't tell you this was a picture of Mercury and I told you it was a picture of just the highlands of the moon, there are very few people who could argue with me, because it looks very much like the lunar highlands. Very, very similar in every sense. The thing you don't see here is very much sign of the large volcanic dark flows that we saw on the lunar surface and those younger looking surfaces. So this I would judge to be an even more primitive planet than the moon. It didn't even have the volcanic events, or if it did, they were so early that they were destroyed by the bombardment record. And so if that any of that kind of thing happened, it happened before the bombardment process and not after. Just another picture taken. Very often they like to get the pictures in low lighting angles. This is the day-night marker on the surface of Mercury. And of course, at low sun angles, the craters are very much emphasized. And you can see these features very well brought out. There are a few smoother places, but again, a picture that would look very reminiscent of lunar highlands. Well, this figure is even simpler than it is for the moon. Nothing up in here other than a little bombardment. And back in here, all sorts of record of the intense bombardment period. I won't talk much about the numbers I put up in here on some of the slides, but Mercury is a fairly dense planet. It means it's got a fair amount of iron lying around, and if it's got a lot of iron lying around, it's probably deep in the interior. So it probably went through a crust core mantle creation process at the beginning, although we've got no direct evidence of this, just that we got light-colored rocks on the surface and we got a lot of heavy stuff in the planet somewhere. And the natural thing is to think of it as being deep in the moon. Deep in Mercury, sorry. Moving out in the solar system to Venus. Venus has been a real problem for the planetary people because Venus has a very thick, dense cloud over it. It's incredibly dense, 100 times as dense as the Earth's atmosphere. It's got all sorts of lovely things in it, like sulfuric acid and who knows what. And on the surface, the temperature of this planet on the surface is so hot that when they landed, the Russians landed the first spacecraft on the surface of Venus, it melted the solder that was in the electrical joints, and the thing only lasted for a few minutes before it simply the solder just melted. So it's several hundred degrees centigrade on the surface. So it's clearly a pretty hostile place to try to do good geological experiments on. Very hot, and as I say, lots of acid around. But there are a lot of creative people around, and we know that radar is very useful for seeing through atmospheric clouds. In the same way, radar has been used to map the surface of Venus and tell us something about its topography. This is a map, a global map, or almost global map, of the surface of Venus, showing the highlands here and up in here, and then the lowlands scattered around in here. Even if you imagine it, something that is slightly circular that might be reminiscent of a crater. Not much of this sort of feature, though. Mostly it looks like the continents that you see on the surface of the Earth. If you would drain the water out of the ocean basins, the surface of the Earth wouldn't look dramatically different than this. And that's a little bit satisfying because Venus is right next door to the Earth, figuratively that is, and its size is very similar to the size of the Earth. So it's rather attractive to find that there are these very large mountains, very large plateaus on the surface of this planet. The extremely high priority mission for the near future for Venus is going to be a much higher resolution radar mapping mission, because the scale of things here is such that we can't pick out things like mid-ocean ridges or the great trenches that we see on the Earth and so on. Maybe they're on Venus, but we couldn't see those at the scale that that the mapping has been done to date. So Venus, in many ways, is similar to the Earth, but in many ways may be very different when we get down to the details, which we really haven't got yet. There have been a couple of photographs from the surface of the planet, as I said, just before the spacecraft, the Russian spacecraft, lost its ability to do any work. This is the footpad that you see here, and these are chunks of rock sitting around on the surface of the planet Venus, but you really can't say whether they're volcanic or what they are. You could just see that there's chunks of stuff there, and it would be great to get chunks of them and see what they are, but we really don't know yet. We will probably have in the near future some additional information. The Russians have had just very recent spacecraft go by Venus and some probes go in what's not very widely known. The Russians are only able to get signals from a very limited place on the surface of Venus. So with a fairly quiet agreement that was worked out, the Americans collected the data and said, if you land over here someplace where you guys can't collect the data, we'll collect the data and give it back to you. And that data hasn't yet been fully worked out because it was collected on one system and it was gathered for another, and they're still trying to work out and sort out exactly how to clear the data. But there's more information will be coming in the fairly near future about Venus as a result of this cooperative venture in one team bringing back the data and the other team sending the spacecraft to a certain place on the surface. Well, many question marks for the surface of Venus. Not enough evidence to say whether we could see, probably can't see much sign of this intense bombardment period in the earlier history. Probably was a crust forming and core forming event. It's the same size as the Earth, so it probably had something similar, but we can't say much about it. Clearly there are continental sized blocks. We don't know when they formed, but they're somewhere along in this area. And it seems as though much of the surface is quite young, because you would expect to see a lot more craters of large size than you actually see. But just an immense number of question marks about the evolutionary history of Venus as a planet. Well, I won't dwell very long on the Earth. We all know a great deal about the Earth, but I thought, as long as I'm going through the planets from the inner part of the solar system to the outer part, I should at least mention it in passing. We know that the Earth had an early melting event and formed the crust, mantle, and core. We know this from the study of seismic waves as a result of earthquakes and, in fact, nuclear explosions as well, but mainly earthquakes. And we know that the Earth has this layered structure. And by inference, we believe some of the other planets do as well. We know that there's this immense amount of volcanic activity that takes place on the surface of the Earth, and it takes place at very well-defined locations. Clearly nothing like this happens on the Moon. Clearly nothing like this on Mercury. We can't say yet for Venus, and when we take a look at some of the Mars stuff, we will see good signs of volcanic activity, but nothing on the scale of the global scale that we have in the case of the Earth. This is clearly the case of a planet that is creating a lot of internal heat and has to work hard to get rid of that heat, and it gets rid of that heat by bringing it up through the ocean floors and through and taking some of it through these various volcanoes and seismic events and so on. So this is a planet with a lot of internal heat, which is driving itself. And from our point of view of getting to the early history, it really is destroying the early record. This is just an indication of the process. We have not seen in any other planetary object concrete evidence of the same process of material coming up, spreading across, and then being dragged down into the Earth again. So we've not really seen this cycle. I will talk a little bit later, though, about one planetary object which is much more active even than the Earth. So the Earth isn't the most active place in the solar system. There are other places that are even more active than this. Well, I've just put a few points on the mark here. I made this slide for an Ontario audience, so I apologize for saying oldest rocks in Ontario. I guess you don't have any that age in British Columbia anyway, so. Again, the formation of core mantle and crust in the early time. No record whatsoever of this bombardment event that we have recorded so elegantly now in other planets. The fossil record started back here, just a drop in the bucket, and the Atlantic Ocean reopened way back here only a couple of hundred million years ago, and it's just nothing compared to the timescales that we're concentrating on, which are back in here. There are rocks that have now been found on Earth as old as about 3.7 or 3.8 billion years, but they're very isolated, localized occurrences. Well, moving on out into the solar system a little further, we come to Mars. Mars is a very interesting object because it turns out to be sort of halfway between. About half of it is volcanic and about half of it is old cratered terrains. So it's much more evolved than Mercury, considerably more evolved than the Moon, and it does have a lot more volcanic activity. On the other hand, we see no signs of the great ridges and trenches that we see on the Earth. So while it's trying to get rid of some heat, it doesn't have as much of a problem as the Earth does in getting rid of its heat. Just a picture of the red planet as the spacecraft were approaching it, and you can see some of the heavy cratering that's going on in here. That terrain presumably is more than 4 billion years in age. It's also the site of the largest known volcano in the solar system. This is an absolutely enormous feature. Doesn't look so big in the picture, but it's very, very large volcano. What's interesting about it, many things are interesting, but one of the things that's interesting about it is, with the exception of one or two small craters on this, impact craters, there is almost no sign of bombardment on this. And that tells us, roughly speaking, what its age is. That tells us that it's a very, very young feature. It may have started old a long time ago, but the last eruptions have covered over any old craters that were there, and so this is a planet that is erupting in volcanic activity up until fairly recent times. A picture from the surface landing on the surface of this planet. This is a little bit more complicated to interpret than the Moon, because there's a little bit of atmosphere and it blows sand around a little bit from here and there, and there's a little bit of water that's there and it creates a few valleys and so on when there's a flood. So the surface isn't quite as fresh, if you like, as some of the other planetary surfaces, but you could see the sand kind of building up around here. In fact, this looks like the painted desert of Arizona, if you've had a chance to visit that. You can see there the wind has piled up a bit of dust around the edges of these rock samples. But still, basically, a planet that is about half very old and about half quite young. Every once in a while on Mars, there must be either a volcanic eruption that dumps out a lot of water from permafrost. It's cold enough that most of the water there is frozen. Or there must be an impact. And there are beautiful features like this that are obviously carved by flowing fluids on the surface of this planet. So not only wind, but water has had quite a chance to carve features. This water comes out, and of course it immediately just goes back in again. It freezes up, so it's kind of a flash flood every 50 or 100 million years, or something of that sort. A picture from the surface of Mars, and again you can see these are now typical volcanic rocks in the volcanic parts of the surface, and you can see that these samples look very much like terrestrial volcanic rocks, or for that matter, like lunar volcanic rocks. This is the footpad of the spacecraft in the front, and again you see these rock samples, which unfortunately we can't date, but by looking at the crater counts and using the lunar information, we can get a rough idea. Mars has a couple of small satellites, very small, about 15 or 20 kilometers in size, Phobos and Deimos, and they managed to get some pretty good looks at the cratering even on these small objects. And even on these small objects, you can see the crater counts. The Russians recently announced that they're going to have a mission to Phobos and Deimos in the next within the next 4 or 5 years, so we can look forward to a lot more information about these two small satellites of Mars. Well, time scale. Again, presumably the early event that formed the crust, presumably at 4.6 billion years. The southern hemisphere is essentially all bombarded, heavily cratered terrain, and therefore, if our lunar clock is right, 4 billion years or more in age. And the volcanoes, we can't date exactly, but we know they're pretty young relative to this event because there are very few craters involved in these volcanic events. Phobos and Deimos are both heavily cratered surfaces, so I've simply indicated that they're somewhere back in this range. Let's go on out to Jupiter. I don't intend to say anything much about Jupiter itself, but I do want to talk about... This one is Io. Io has turned out to be one of the most fascinating objects in the solar system. Just 2 days before the spacecraft got to the planet and took these pictures and returned them, a paper appeared in the journal Science, and it predicted that this planet was going to be extremely hot and highly volcanic. It was a most abstruse paper because nobody had imagined that that was going to be the case at all. It's a very small object and should effectively lose its heat. It shouldn't be an object that keeps heat very effectively. But this prediction was based on looking carefully at the gravitational forces that would act on this satellite as a result of its proximity to Jupiter and some very complicated celestial mechanics experiments, measurements, calculations, and they predicted that there was going to be a lot of heat being dumped into this planet and that this planet was going to be a most unusual, or satellite, I should say, a most unusual object. And sure enough, 2 days later, back came the pictures, and what you see here is not craters, what you see here is volcanic vents on the surface of this planet. During the course of the missions, of the photographing of the missions, while two spacecraft went past this object, they actually saw 10 volcanoes in eruption, far more active and dynamic than the Earth. Here is one of them. You can see the gases being emitted from a volcano and spewing out, making this incredibly magnificent halo associated with the erupting gases. Just a very dynamic planetary object. Another picture of the same thing. You can see again this erupting material. And the second spacecraft that went by a short while later, and the eruptions were taking place somewhere else. So this is a very, very dynamic object within the solar system. As you go out a little further from Jupiter, you come to the satellite Europa. Europa is a pretty fair-sized object itself, but again you see essentially no sign of surface cratering. It's totally different than the lunar stuff. In fact, if I were to give you a photograph, perhaps a satellite photograph from Arctic pack ice, and you were to compare that with this photograph on all these long cracks and so on, you'd say that's not a picture of a satellite, that's a picture of Arctic ice with the cracks and fractures as the blocks of ice jiggle around one against the other. Well, that's probably what this is. This is probably a planet which has water on the surface, and the top part of that is probably frozen, and that means that there's no record of bombardment activity. And while you've got a very interesting planetary object or satellite, you're now looking at one whose surface is just totally recycled and is basically just an ice-covered planet. Another picture of the same thing. Again, you see the dynamics of these, magnificent cracks and fractures, and not a hint of a cratering feature on the surface of this. And nobody would have predicted that either. That was just absolutely unexpected. Ganymede is the next one out, next large one out, and Ganymede is also a very interesting object. You do see in these dark regions lots of craters. You see lots of features of this kind. But you also see what we can't resolve very well, these enormous belts all across the surface. Just to give you a sense of scale, this belt is about the size of the Himalayas. So these are pretty fair-sized belts across the surface of these small planetary objects. It suggests to us that most of this satellite is old. Most of it reflects the early bombardment, the pre-4 billion years, but it also suggests to us that there has been some mountain-building activity on this small satellite, and that this is probably a younger feature resulting from internal processes overriding the effect of the cratered surfaces. So far, three satellites, Jupiter, and everyone different. And the fourth one, Callisto, is as saturated as you can get with respect to craters. And although the picture is very dark here, if we change the color slightly and compared it to a lunar picture, the lunar highlands, you wouldn't tell the difference really between this and a lunar highlands picture. A very large crater here, somewhat late in the history of the satellite, but you can see a very heavily cratered surface. So the four Galilean satellites turned out to be four very different objects with quite different life cycles or evolutionary patterns. So, Callisto, intense bombardment, 4 billion years and earlier, and that's all we see. Ganymede, we see a lot of the intense bombardment activity, maybe a little mountain building activity, but we can't date it very well, but it would seem that it's a bit younger. Europa, we can't even really say because it's just covered with water and ice, and Io has modern day current volcanism, and probably this block shouldn't be that long. It should probably just be a little line at zero on this scale, because there's nothing on the surface of that surely that has lasted more than a few tens or hundreds of millions of years at the very most on that one. Well, the next object out was Saturn. There have been magnificent pictures of Saturn itself. I don't intend to talk very much about Saturn or even about its rings. There's a whole marvelous story about the rings and some of the things that are coming out about it, but I'd like to talk about the satellites. We have pictures of most of these. Iapetus, I don't have any of Hyperion to show you tonight. Titan, Rhea, Dione, Tethys, they've got good pictures of Enceladus, although I didn't bring any tonight, and Mimas. So I'll show you pictures of four or five of these satellites. Just for scale, the moon is this size, and Titan, which is quite a large object, is of course quite a lot bigger. The rest of these are much smaller objects. This is Tethys. The resolution isn't extremely good, but if you spend a while looking at this, you can see that it's quite heavily cratered. A little bit bleached out with the colors here, but this picture was brought out to emphasize this enormous canyon across the surface of this small satellite. This canyon is about the size of the Grand Canyon, and it's just amazing. Here it is, all the way across this object. Probably the result of some internal process taking place on this satellite. We don't know, but there it is. This is Iapetus. Iapetus has been one of the most peculiar objects in the solar system. The astronomers have known for a long time that when they sit and look at it, it goes from light to dark. And they really couldn't understand it very well until they got the good pictures back, and sure enough, half of it's light colored and half of it's dark colored. Simple as that. Why that is, we don't know, but there's at least one theory that says the light colored side is always facing towards the sun and into the solar wind, and therefore it has been modified as a result of that, and the trailing side has not been. Whether that's the only reason or whether it's some internal process that has made the geology of one side different than the other is something we can only speculate on. This shows you the boundary between the dark and the light part of Iapetus. And interestingly enough, you can see a ring feature there which looks just like a big crater. So probably cratering on this object as well. So at least parts of it are very old. Oh. Oh, I picked the wrong one. This is Mimas. Again, if you didn't know the scale of this object, you'd look at it and say lunar highlands exactly, 4 billion years or more in age. Provided, of course, these satellites all saw the same flux of meteorites and asteroids and things of that sort. But a very, very, very heavily cratered surface. In fact, this picture of another side of Mimas shows one of the most magnificent craters in the solar system. Just an absolutely beautiful thing. You can see that it has this big cone in the center, which is typical of very large craters. When the impact occurs, if they're very large, there's a rebound, and you get an actual mountain formed in the center, presumably stuff that came from great depth. It's also interesting to speculate what would have happened to this satellite if that crater had been, or impact had been, just slightly larger. I suspect this would have been several satellites in the process. This is Dione. And again, you can see this intensely bombarded lunar highlands-like material, 4 billion years or more in age. But interestingly, you can see some dark material here. We're not sure, again, what process it is that's caused this. Maybe it's a process of some kind of internal geological activity. It's a very low-density planet, so we think a lot of it is ice, so it's a little hard to imagine just what process this that's caused this. But this is also not just a simple planet like Mercury, where there's been a fairly uniform history for the last 4 billion years. This is just a different color rendition of that same feature. And again, you can see that it's not at all a simple planet. And maybe there's been some internal dynamic processes taking place in this small satellite. This is Titan. Titan is one of the also very interesting places in the solar system. Titan has got a very, very thick, dense atmosphere over it. And so from the point of view of geosciences and geologists and geophysicists and so on, we really have no idea of what the surface is like. We don't know if it's mountainous or got valleys or craters or whatever, because they have not yet seen through this thick cover. It's a long ways from the sun and is very cold, and most of this atmosphere is nitrogen. And it's quite interesting to speculate whether it has oceans on the surface of this satellite that are made of something like liquid nitrogen or liquid methane or liquid something or other, and in fact have a whole set of geological processes taking place as a result of gases that in our imagination we never dream of as being liquid, because this is a very, very cold very cold satellite, and there could well be liquid on the surface. This is one of the few places that it is still widely speculated that there may be some kind of life processes, because it is thought that the gases that form this are the primitive gases of the solar system. And if that's the case and they haven't escaped, this may be the primordial soup out of which people speculate that life processes on Earth began. We no longer have any record on Earth of this atmosphere, so this may be some of the real stuff. At least it's speculated that way. This is Rhea, and again you see this intense bombardment, lunar highlands-like material, and again 4 billion years or more in age. Saturn has a couple of very tiny satellites that haven't even been given names yet. I think this is S11 or something, and this is just a few kilometers across. Again, you see a very non-uniform object. It's not even spherical at all, and a few craters on it. Well, this just summarizes the history of Saturn's satellites. Rhea, Dione, Tethys, Mimas. All showing signs of these heavily bombarded highland-like materials. The dark surface on Dione that I mentioned. I put the Titan atmosphere early because if it did form early in the solar system and is still there, it's in itself extremely fascinating. The fracture on Tethys is probably younger, and the dark part of Dione's surface is probably younger. So these are not totally simple objects. But of course, they're nothing like Io or the Earth or the very active satellites. Well, I said at the beginning that the Moon did not, in fact, give us the Rosetta Stone of the solar system. It didn't bring us back a piece of that primordial material that everybody was looking for. But of course, what's happened since then is people have been looking around to see if we have any or where could we find some of the primordial stuff. And a lot of attention has turned back to the meteorites. The meteorites, almost without exception, turn out to have ages of about 4.6 billion years. It seems almost certain now that they are the materials that made up the early days of the solar system, and if we can simply read the record adequately and pull out the particles and so on in them, maybe we can get a good handle on the early history of the solar system. So when we look at satellites and planets and so on, I believe we have to add meteorites to the mix. This is a meteorite, a sliced meteorite that fell in Alberta some years ago, and you can see big chunks of material. This is obviously the result of very complicated processes in the early solar system, bombardment and breaking particles apart and welding them together again, and there's big pieces with little pieces in them, and the little pieces have little pieces in them again, and so on. So there are many events that are recorded in this before this finally reaches the surface of the Earth. This is a sliced meteorite. Again, you can see these big inclusions and chunks of material in here. This one is from Elephant Moraine in Antarctica. And that's turned out to be absolutely fascinating because in the last 5 or 6 years, the Japanese and the Americans have discovered an immense number of meteorites preserved on the ice of the Antarctic ice cap and have still mounting expeditions there. And in the last 4 or 5 years, we have doubled our collections in the world of primordial solar system material coming from these meteorites. In that collection, they have actually found pieces of material that are almost certainly come from the Moon because they have exactly the composition and ages of the lunar materials. And there's very wide speculation that they have found materials in that collection that have actually come from Mars. That's not quite so dogmatically stated. But the gases that are trapped in these meteorites look very much like the gases that were measured when the satellites were sitting on the surface, when the spacecraft were sitting on the surface of Mars, measuring the gases and some very unusual gas compositions that were found. So it's really amazing when you begin to look back at it and say, yes, we had a lot of that stuff around, but of course, without the whole picture, we couldn't begin to put it into context. Well, for meteorites, essentially formed at 4.6 billion years, there are chunks within some of these meteorites that are believed to predate the formation of the solar system itself, And there's certainly a lot of speculation that we may have grains in these that have come from other solar systems than our own. There have been bombardment processes and so on that have taken place, and a few meteorites come in with younger ages, but usually you can work your way through it and still get back to the 4.6 billion year age. Well, I don't want to go on very much further. There's an awful lot of very interesting and exciting stuff yet to be done in the exploring and interpreting of the solar system. There is lots of speculation about return missions to the moon. I think one of the most exciting things that's going on right now is the distinct possibility that there may turn out to be clear evidences of other solar systems. You may have read recently about the infrared astronomy satellite, which got some magnificent infrared pictures into nearby solar systems, and it looks like all the world there's solar systems there. When the space shuttle and the Hubble Space Telescope gets going in the next few years, there is now almost a certainty that they will be able to actually astrometrically measure the wobble of a star if it has a satellite the size of Jupiter going around it. So that these two objects, because of the gravitational attraction, that star will be sitting there wobbling slightly as a result of this rotating satellite. That's within the next 5 years, there will be specific searches for the wobble of stars, which would be clear evidence of satellites. There are other ways of looking at it. If it's a large satellite, as it comes across the front face of a star, it's going to make it a few percent darker because you got this dark object in front of it, so people are going to look for periodic darkenings of satellites and so on. So it seems to be the opportunities for beginning to look not just within our solar system, but to look a little bit beyond our solar system and actually infer almost directly the presence of other solar systems is going to be immense. And of course, when you think about that, the horizons that opens are just amazing. The radio astronomers won't have to sit and say, where do we point the telescope to see if there's life out there somewhere? They can say, we're going to know that there's a satellite there, and we know there's a solar system, so let's point our telescopes in that direction, or let's pick those five objects where we know these things are and take a hard look at that. So lots to learn and understand and interpret. We still don't have the Rosetta Stone of the solar system, but we're getting a lot closer. There are missions to comets, which presumably are the sources or will be sources of primitive primordial materials, and it's just a matter of years till we're actually out there looking at asteroids. There's over 100 known Earth-crossing asteroids. When you think about it, we're at the bottom of an extremely deep potential well. It takes us a number of, whatever the number is, 11 point whatever it is, kilometers per second to get off of the surface of the Earth. Once we get off it, though, moving around out there is extremely energy efficient. Just a little shot here and a little shot there, and you can get from place to place. Our big problem is that we are captives of this well that we're sitting at the bottom of. And the things that we can do as we look beyond and get out there, back to the moon, for example, the kind of experiments that can be done there are going to be amazing. We are polluting our radio signal environment of the Earth so badly that maybe in 20 years the radio astronomers will want to do all of their work on the far side of the moon, where they're shielded from all of our microwave signals and everything else, because that's the only place they can get to get really quiet environments to take an even deeper look into space. Well, I'll just flash through a few slides. This is now artist's conception. This is what a lunar base might look like. Getting off of the surface of the moon only takes about 3.4 kilometers per second of velocity, so you don't even have to do very much to get off. You can do it ballistically. And that long linear feature there is a sketch of a ballistic device that would simply accelerate it down here and haul off materials or soil or whatever you'd like off the surface and simply take it out into space where you could make use of it if you wanted it. This would be a garden that they're working out here, not the garden as we would think about it, but this is where they're putting out their solar collectors so that they have enough energy to power this this mine on the lunar surface. Here is where they're doing the actual trenching and hauling the stuff out, bringing it into here, putting it in buckets, ore buckets basically, and then just shooting it off the surface. We could have that by the end of the decade. The end of the century. This is a space shuttle sitting up here, just again an artist's conception of the kinds of things you would be doing in terms of building all kinds of intriguing structures and hauling materials up from the moon to work on these structures. Another transport system, this would be instead of flying the guys up to Baffin Island or wherever our nearest mine is, we'd fly them up to the moon, and this would be the transport vehicle that would haul them back and forth. Here it is coming up to rendezvous with a station. Well, these are all just artist's conceptions. A telescope on the lunar surface, what it would take, what it would look like. Sampling on the lunar surface, studying the soil materials. Working out the solar power converting devices so that you could have these surfaces to send the energy into your station. Asteroid operations. I don't know if you ever thought about what it would be like working on an asteroid, but a 1 kilometer size object has almost no gravity. And when you start to think about how you collect a sample from an object that has no gravitational effect on it, you know, you can't lean down and hammer away at it, you'll go away instead of the sample. So, you know, just simply speculating about how you do that is in fact interesting. And finally, if all else fails, and nobody lets us get out there for any other reason, I'm sure there'd be some kind of a market. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, just stay put. We'll be back within 10 minutes. I think two questions.
The question was asked to me when they first landed, they had a joke about purple rocks, and I know you're going to think this isn't true, but I don't know what the joke was about purple rocks. Purple rocks, of course, the purple and orange rocks have been of a lot of interest to geologists because they would infer, particularly the orange ones, but the purple ones also refer all kinds of alteration processes and so on, so it may have been that they were, you know, there was a particular site that they had been on a particular mission that said, hey, we saw some purple stuff out there.
I'm sure that's what it was, but I wasn't on that particular field trip.
Yes, in relation to the exploration of the planets, do you have any specific comments regarding the proposed SDI research?
Well, yeah, the question was in regard to the exploration of planets, do I have any comments with respect to SDI research? The comment I would make, it would be to back up and say the opportunity that those of us in universities and the communities that involve open research and open activities and so on was really immense. But you must remember that none of the Apollo program was done specifically for science. The Apollo program was a strategic mission to show that the U.S. could do it, in effect, and to show the technological superiority. It was post-Sputnik era, and there would never have been an Apollo program if only the scientists had wanted the Apollo program and an opportunity to study the moon. So my comment is a very simple one. My comment is that we as scientists were extremely fortunate to be able to get in and have a major influence on what was done, and to be able to do the stuff that we did and put it all out without any exception into the open sector. No one ever said to me, you can't do this, you can't do that. I briefed the press, I think, at every mission from Apollo 12 on, and I never had an instruction as to what I could or couldn't say. Now, whether SDI will have that kind of openness to it or not is a question I don't know the answer to. If it doesn't have that kind of openness, then I guess I'm not terribly interested in it. But if there's opportunities and openness of that kind, then that's a different question.
Question. I've read recently of reports of bacterial type fossils found in rocks that are 3.8 billion years old in Western Australia and Greenland.
Yes?
Is there any credibility to those reports?
The question was that they found signs, he's read recently that there are signs of bacterial-type fossils in rocks 3.8 and 3.7 billion years in age found in Western Australia and in Greenland. And the answer is yes. Those materials are in themselves, in many cases, sedimentary rocks, and they do contain clear evidences of ancient life. They're also the result of water and fluid processes. So it's clear that already by that time on the Earth, some fluid was already there. There must have been some kind of oceans. Whether they're similar to ours or not, we don't know. There was probably an atmosphere, maybe different than our atmosphere, and there was some kind of life forms active at that time. I think that is now pretty unambiguous.
Dr. Strangway, we're going to have to move on to the next room.
Yeah, the question was, do I have any comment on the possibility of life in the ocean of Europa? And I should actually have made mention of that, because if you were now to look at these objects and say, where would life be? I talked about Titan, but I think Europa, with all of the water that must be beneath that ice, has got to have stuff that is of the right temperature, in effect, temperature conditions and the fluids and so on. So I think that's also a very likely place to go looking for life forms.
One more question.
Any reason why there are four satellites on Saturn or Jupiter? One is so young. Is that a recently formed satellite?
Yeah, the question was asked, basically, what was the reason why the satellites of Jupiter, one in particular, looks so young. That satellite was probably not formed recently. In fact, maybe I was not as clear as I should have been. Our impression is that all of the satellite objects, the meteorites, the asteroids, perhaps even much of the cometary material, was all originates from 4.6 billion years. Some of it has been recycled in many different forms, and so we have no record of what it was like in the early days. And Io, in particular, has been recycled so many times that it's even recycling today. So the stuff probably was, of course, of the original composition, but, you know, the gases have been given off, and a lot of it's very different, and probably a lot of sulfur is now built up, in fact, on the surface of that planet.
We'll have to move on. But just let me say that there's almost certainly going to be some space in the main hall. So if you want to just come along and tuck in there and find a seat, I'm sure.
I'm not sure I. Oh, the question was, what can I say about the space station and its main scientific benefits? You know, like so many of these enormous projects, the decision for space station clearly wasn't driven by the scientists. There will be fascinating scientific things to do, and they've just got to give the opportunity to do it. Otherwise, an opportunity will be missed. A lot of us were pushing very hard for less emphasis on the space station with all of its strategic and military implications, and we're pushing much harder for the concept of return to the moon, with return to perhaps manned missions on Mars and all the rest of it. And I still hope that when the whole picture is put together, that that will be a part of it. If you ask what can we do on space station, there's lots of fascinating things to be done. It's a zero-G environment to start with. It's an environment with immense amount of, the vacuum. We just can't build vacuums that good on the Earth. So when you think about the kinds of sort of physics and chemistry experiments and mass spectrometry experiments, things that require, low gravity or very high vacuum, for example, lots of things to be done. So I think there are many, many interesting scientific things to be done for space station, and like everything, there's a priority. The decision to build space station, however, in my judgment, was not particularly or fundamentally driven by the scientists trying to get a space station.
One more question. Yes.
Mars is smaller than Venus, yet you said Mars had the largest volcano in the solar system. So this should give us some idea of geophysics of the surface of both planets.
Yes.
Would you then predict, because Venus should be more plastic perhaps, that there would be rifting and plate tectonics on Venus?
The question was asked, since Mars is quite a bit smaller than Venus and yet appears to have a very large volcano, for example, as I showed you, relative to Venus, would I predict that that the result is that Venus would have a lot more plate tectonic and activity, much like the Earth? Did I phrase that? Well, let me just recap for a moment. If all other things were equal, if the amount of heat that was put into a planet when it came together was the same, if the amount of heat generating materials were the same, a large object would be much less capable of getting rid of its heat than a small object. So if everything in the solar system were absolutely equal, I'd pick the largest object and say it's going to be the hottest and the most volcanic and the most seismically active, and just scale them down in size. As you saw tonight, it didn't work that way. The Earth is one of the large ones and it's very active. Io is a very small one and it's very active. Mercury is a moderate-sized one and is almost inactive. The Moon is fairly small and was active, at least for a while. So the cycle is, the simplicity is simply not there. What this must mean is either that the heat that was put into the planet when it was formed was different in the different objects, or they have different amounts of heat-generating radioactive elements in them, and therefore over their life cycles they have been different, or some other process is adding heat. So for me to predict what we're going to find on Venus is something that I'm not particularly willing to do, but I'll tell you a couple of things that will make it, I'm sure, different than the Earth. First of all, it's very hot at the surface, and if that atmosphere kept it hot through much of its history, that means a solid crust on that planet must be very thin. And secondly, if it's very hot, there's no water around, so there's nothing to lubricate it. So I have a feeling that the tectonics of Venus are going to look very different than the tectonics of Earth when we actually get down there and have a good look at them.
Well, we must go back to the main hall, but there almost certainly will be some seats there, so if you'd like to just move over.
The question was asked when I talked about the similarity of rocks, meteorites found in Antarctica. I said they looked like the Moon and some of them looked very much like what people thought Mars would look like. He was asking me whether this was in effect a coincidence and that other places might have had things that looked like the Moon or Mars, or whether these are inferred to have come directly from the Moon. The inference is clear, and the dynamics have been looked at, that they could have come from the Moon as a result of dynamic impacts. So we may actually have other samples of the Moon scattered around in places that we haven't known or recognized on the surface of the Earth, and we may have samples of Mars in the same way. So the inference I was trying to leave was specifically say, yes, we may have pieces as a result of the bombardment processes in the solar system. The question was asked, in thinking about the solar system, have we come to any conclusions about the existence or non-existence of a creator? You know, it's a very, very hard question to answer, and it's the sort of thing you can give flippant responses to. I remember once addressing a group of people when I was in the senior office at the University of Toronto, when they were people in religious studies. And I couldn't think of a thing to say to these people as welcome them to this conference. And I said, the only difference between you and me is the time scale. What I'm basically saying is we really don't understand 4.6 billion years ago. And for us in the world of science, we have to accept that we don't know what in the heck it was that happened at that time. And we're going to keep trying to work to get through that gap, but when we get through that gap, the astronomers will tell us there's another 10 billion years you got to worry about. And so there's an awful lot of unanswered questions, and whether we'll answer them all ever is a question I don't know.
Question, do you have any ideas about what happened at the 4
The question was asked, do I have any idea what happened at 4 billion years to create the impact? And the speculation on that is, there's only two possibilities. One is there was an immense amount of activity that took place only over a short period of time, so it was a unique event, if you like, in the solar system. And the other possibility is that it was the tail end and the last of the process that was actually leading to the formation of the solar system and was the tail end, and all we can see is that curtain and we can't sort of see through it anymore. If you do very simple back of the envelope calculations about how much material was bombarding the moon at that time, it is very hard to conceive that that rate of bombardment could have been continuous for half a billion years. There would be so much material involved in that. So if it was the latter, that is, if it was the notion that this was the tail end of a process, it's a process that didn't just go this way, it must have gone this way. Must have had an S-shaped curve to it. And then beyond that, I can't say anything. It was either a peak or an S-shape, but it could not have been a simple exponential just extrapolation all the way back to 4.6. There's just too much material that would have to be involved in that process.
Question here.
Could you comment on or speculate on what the reasons are for the different characteristics of the four Galilean satellites of Jupiter? They are very different. Are there any speculations?
Yeah, the question was, could I speculate on the reasons for the differences between the four Galilean satellites? One of the most fundamental differences that was on the slides, but which I didn't really talk about, was that two of them are quite rocky and two of them are quite icy. So right from the start, the composition of those four fall into two groups. So we got two groups of two instead of one group of four. The surface features, which is all we've really had a look at, other than the looking at the overall density, say that the heat sources must have been very different. That is, during the lifetime of Jupiter, this tidal friction process must have just continued dumping heat into that object and just kept pouring the heat to it all through its geological history. So it's maybe overly simplistic, but one imagines that as you move out from the satellite, from the central planet, that you're getting into less and less of that kind of heat dumped in. What's even more intriguing about it is that back when I was a student, I remember all of the people telling me that tidal friction was one of the great sources of heat for the Earth, and somewhere along the way they abandoned that, and so we thought tidal friction was no longer important, and now we've got another satellite where it is important. Just is clearly important. So, you know, these things come and go.
Dr. Tiger, in your studies, have you come up with a possible explanation for the reversal of the magnetic field in the world?
Yeah, the question was asked, I presume, or anybody else got good explanations of the reversal of the Earth's magnetic field? What I didn't really talk about as much of the magnetic field discussions, which is what my own, in fact, day-to-day measurements are all about. But it's well known now that the Earth's magnetic field reverses itself about every 500,000 or 600,000 years, every few million years at the most, which basically means that north becomes south and south becomes north. And it's quite a straightforward flips from one to the other. We don't understand the cause of that reversal process. People make mathematical models of the process of how the fluids moving in the core create the magnetic field, and then they wave their hands and say, well, it's a nonlinear process, and once you get into nonlinear processes, you can have all kinds of instabilities take place, and then you can have this happen. No one has come up with a good physical explanation as to what the reversal mechanism is, why it has characteristic time scales associated with it, and so on. So the reversing of the Earth's magnetic field is a well-established experimental phenomenon waiting for a good theory.
Take two more questions. Right,
like a lot of things in what I was talking about tonight.
What happened from magnetic experiments